Shake the niggas. Scary hours, no money out. Smash the Guinness style, play the outfield. Lucille switch cracks on chill. She's a rich fiend. Sacrifice a fan, ship the niggas to
Hey guys, welcome to the sixth crack podcast and the second meal episode. I guess we should introduce ourselves and not assume.
Wait, it's the second one. I think on the second one, that's now everything. All your work is done. That's when you start coasting.
Everyone will be cracked. Podcast.
Yeah.
Completed.
Second episode of your podcast on. It's just raking in that cheddar.
So I'm Jack O'Brien. I'm the editor in chief of Cracked. And Michael is
I am Michael Swaim. Hello. Yeah, still sound guy? I was going to try and do a new bit every episode.
And I stepped on it. This episode's going to be sort of like the first one. We're calling them meal episodes in the sense that they're a bunch of different segments.
Now, a meal episode, that doesn't mean... I thought we were being going to be served food
at
this
session. Did you come
hungry? That's not what that implies.
No.
I always come hungry.
It means that we're going to be covering one big, broad, important subject from a bunch of different angles. Mm-hmm. We're going to have a bunch of different people, and it's going to be lots of different ideas and stories. Stories, especially in this one, because this week's episode is origin stories. So most people are familiar with origin stories as sort of a comic book trope, right? It's how superheroes come to be. Spider-Man gets bitten by a spider.
I'm not familiar with his.
Batman's mom has sex with a
spoiler alert.
I believe.
Yeah, that's your, well, how would you get a Batman?
We're going to take it outside of just the comic book approach to some real world versions of origin stories. For instance, the organization of the keys on your keyboard. Michael, I see you have a computer.
That's very personal to bring up. I told you that in confidence. Yeah, I do. And I see that the upper left corner of it spells QWERTY.
I think I remember when I first started learning to type, it seemed somewhat counterintuitive, but I just assumed, well, they do this for a reason, clearly.
It seems pretty arbitrary. It seems like they just scattered a bag of Scrabble tiles.
Right.
And were like, that is the order of the keyboard. That's fine.
I guess I trusted that there was like some ergonomic reason for it, you know?
Right. Scientists thought about how typing is going to work, and they're like, oh, that.
If you look down at your hands, assuming you're at a keyboard, your right pointer finger, which is like your most dominant finger.
It's overdeveloped from usage.
It is resting on the J key, which has a Scrabble score of 8 for a reason. It is a infrequently used letter in the English language. Another finger on your right hand is resting on the semicolon, which you never use that.
You never use it? How do you separate sequences of lists which would otherwise be complete clauses?
I don't know.
Okay, sorry. Keep going.
So the reason that we have this completely illogical and practical organization of keys that is giving us
carpal
time.
Yeah, I'm feeling it.
We actually looked into why that was the case a while back on the site. One theory is that back when it was being designed, if you typed keys that were close together quickly, they would jam the little hammers.
Just because we're talking typewriters, right, with the actual mechanical hammers.
That's a good point. I should establish that.
There was a time when you typed with a machine.
Right.
You idiot that I'm hypothetically talking to.
So the theory is that they had to scatter the keys far apart from one another and make it intentionally hard to type quickly because otherwise people would hit the same keys at the same time and the hammers would jam, essentially. And that has recently allegedly been debunked, although I'm not totally convinced. The debunking theory goes that it had something to do with operators who were beta testing typewriters back in the 1890s were translating from Morse code or taking down Morse code. And so it was something with the organization of the S, Z, and E key needing to be close to each other and in some organization. Sounds like bullshit to me, but then I don't know Morse code, so...
The thing is, you gotta realize Morse code is most often used to discuss Patrick Swayze and Swayze-related things, so you need that S, Z, and E right there, you know? You just need that
within... I was wondering within, where you were going.
Right? Took me a while to figure that out.
As I was reading this theory that supposedly debunked the version that we had covered, they kind of mentioned a side note that sort of explains the whole thing to me and I think is the actual important part of the origin story. So one of the early manufacturers and the one that invested in this QWERTY key arrangement was Remington, the people who made a bunch of the rifles that killed people during the Civil War. So the Civil War had just ended. They were looking to diversify. Typewriters, hey. Good,
maybe you could kill people with this.
Anything. Yeah.
It's heavy.
They invested in the QWERTY arrangement of keys. And when you would buy a typewriter, you could sign up for Remington classes that taught you how to type on this QWERTY keyboard. So whether it was Morse code, whether it was the keys jamming together, that seems to be the important thing, that a big company invested in teaching people to type on this crazy scattering of keys.
And they were a gun company, so if they were like, type this way, you were like, yeah, okay, Remington, all right.
Whatever you say, Remington. But that sort of makes sense when you look at the modern world, and one of the main reasons that I hate switching between Mac and PC is because it's hard to learn the hotkeys and like get yourself out of the habit of, you know, using the control versus the Apple command.
Mm-hmm.
And that also would make sense for why there's not a lot of documentation. The reason this is so controversial is because nobody wrote down their reason for putting the QWERTY keys in that order because it was counterintuitive, and therefore you would need their classes to learn to type on that keyboard. And once you learn to type on that, you would want to stick with that. I think it's an old-timey version of taking classes from Apple geniuses that teach you how to use iTunes. It's just one of those ideas that got that way because someone made a decision 150 years ago and we never bothered changing it.
Thanks, Ben Franklin.
I hope that becomes a recurring bit. We're going to cover fake superhero origin stories that we were all raised on. The origin story of America, that a bunch of scrappy colonists overcame the odds and carved America out of the untamed wilderness summer break, which we all enjoyed when we were in school. The president has actually been talking about shortening summer break, and in these speeches, he's been getting the origin story wrong. So we're going to correct the president on today's episode. And if we get to it, we're going to look at the idea of why we're obsessed with origin stories.
And oh, we'll get to it.
I know I told you that I didn't want to do a big thing about like digging deep into history and claiming that America is obsessed with origin stories because of something that happened 300 years ago. I lied. That is going to be my reason.
Oh, thank you, Ben Franklin. Cool. Yeah, good. That's very exciting. Because, yeah, I have my own pet theories about B.F. Skinner and the baby box and all kinds of stuff up that alley. So we'll get to that.
You just made all those words up.
No. It's going to be good. It's going to make sense by the end.
All right. That is on today's episode of the Cracked Podcast.
Woo.
Stick around.
Oh, my goodness, young gutted. What have you done?
All right, so first up, to give you guys a better idea of what we mean by real-world origin stories and sort of the different angles we'll be covering that from, we asked some of our writers and favorite contributors to tell us just amazing true stories about how famous things got started, or mythical superhero origin stories about real-world things that they grew up wanting to be true. And here are five of our favorites.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. It's the 10 Crack Commandments.
Number 1, Wikipedia.
I think how Wikipedia started is the craziest internet origin story, because the people who started Wikipedia didn't think that was a very good idea. Jimmy Wales' team's main idea was Newpedia, which would have been a peer-reviewed online encyclopedia. The peer-review thing pretty much makes it like Britannica or World Books or other dead piles of trees that Wikipedia killed. Wales' team actually made Wikipedia later on as a contributor forum kind of thing for drafts of Newpedia articles. And then they only actually focused on Wikipedia after it ballooned into the trove of facts about the presidents and Buffy that we all love today. I don't know any other revolutionary internet thing that was an afterthought of a bad idea. You know, like, to me, Wikipedia's origin is like if somebody tried to build a free online phone book of plumber landlines and then accidentally invented Skype.
Number 2, Star Trek.
Lucille Ball was directly responsible for Star Trek, the original series, getting on the air. So back in the 60s, when the show was being put together by Gene Roddenberry, Lucy was looking for, at this time she owned Desilu Productions by herself. Desi Arnaz was not involved in it. So she was the first female studio head at the time. And so she was going through all these pitches to do these really high concept shows. And one of them was Star Trek, but she thought that it was a show about celebrities doing USO tours. And just immediately greenlit the series without really giving it a second glance. And now, Star Trek.
How did she think that? Was she confusing it with another show, or is this just further proof that women and their small brains should not run studios? Because Star Trek wasn't like a huge hit at first, right?
No, and in fact, it was really expensive to produce. And they were putting down a lot of money. One of the things that she pioneered on I Love Lucy, which was syndication rights and retaining rights for the show and all that, that was something they kind of banked on with Star Trek that ended up paying off a lot later, because that's been on TV, like a lot of series, just perpetually since it first aired.
So it made
a lot
of money back. She was smart in the end. She used the I Love Lucy kind of syndication model to save Star Trek, and we wouldn't have Star Trek in a number of ways without Lucille Ball's genius.
I guess. Turns out your sexism is just way off the mark this time.
Yeah, usually is.
Number 3, Michael Jordan.
I grew up in the Chicago suburbs in the 90s, so I was obsessed with Michael Jordan. I still kind of am. I hope his underwear spokesmaning and Hitler mustache thing goes great, but Michael's official origin story inspired me to think I could play in the NBA as a kid. The way Michael's story went was that he was cut from his high school team, so then he rage practiced until he became the sneaker logo talent and friend of Bugs Bunny, everybody knows. I later learned that was all bullshit. Michael Jordan was always Michael Jordan. Never got cut from anything. But when he was a high school sophomore, he didn't make varsity, which is pretty normal. But then Michael spent the rest of his life telling people this story of, oh, this high school coach cut me, Michael Jordan. What a yutz, what a goof, right? And then that fib got seen as true, and then also got a positive work ethic-y spin on it. I still wish it was true, because it made me and all my, like, goofy 11-year-old friends think that if we dribbled around the cul-de-sac long enough, we could make the NBA, because we were practicing, you know, even though the only thing we practiced was really just, like, lowering the hoop and then dunking on it.
Number 4. Caligula.
I've heard that Caligula is mostly a figment of having had his enemies write the history of him. People loved him. He was actually just a pretty democratic leader who took power away from the senators. So they assassinated him and made these just crazy ass stories up about him, which kind of makes sense because everything that you hear about Caligula,
right,
that he like
seems to
fucked his
almost
horse, rhymes with the false memories that you get from like the 80s when like people would go on Geraldo after they were hypnotized recovered a memory of demon circles. It just seems so over the top.
Right, and there is that line, history is written by the winners. The funny, you know, blowback of that is people may not have ever even cared or known too much of Caligula.
It was a good PR move, because everyone knows Caligula's name, but it turns out sometimes the winners just have disgusting imagination.
Number 5, ketchup.
I have an origin story for ketchup. I'm very fascinated by ketchup. It's such an iconic American thing. Everyone thinks of ketchup as like, oh, you go to a baseball game in America, you put ketchup on a hot dog, and it just seems so distinctly American, and it was a Chinese invention. It was invented in China in 1690 and didn't actually make its way to America until the 1800s, and they didn't even add tomatoes until then either. So this thing that we know of as ketchup is Chinese and was made from pickled fish and brine. British sailors, conquistadors, they came to China and they're like, this stuff is great, we're gonna bring it to America, we love ketchup. You know what we're gonna change though? Literally everything about it. You know what the very first Heinz slogan for ketchup was?
What?
I like this too because I really love old-fashioned advertising slogans. Blessed relief for mother and the other women in the household.
So I talked to a bunch of those folks when we were putting that medley together with the idea that I would kind of get them to tell their stories quickly and keep things moving. You can hear me asking questions on one or two of the longest stories. And then I ended up just telling a story of my own because I find myself very interesting. But I was especially bad at my job when it came to Christy Harrison, who's one of our editors, and whose stories, two of them, were just so out of control interesting that we ended up talking for 20 minutes, and you're about to hear the highlights from that conversation.
I think the thing about origin stories that we like is they satisfy a narrative that we want to fit our world. And when they don't fit that narrative, then we either dismiss them or we forget about them. And so there were two that I think kind of don't fit the story that we want, and so that's why we don't know the stories. So the first one is about the origins of Planned Parenthood. Wherever you are on abortion rights, we'll just start there, you know who Planned Parenthood is and what they stand for, and that they symbolize choice and reproductive rights. But the founder of Planned Parenthood, Margaret Sanger, she did believe in, obviously, birth control and reproductive rights, but she did not believe that everyone should have access to those choices. So she thought that if you were feeble-minded, those are her words, or had a lifelong disease, that you should be sterilized or segregated from the rest of the population for your entire reproductive years. And the language that she used is harsh. She used the phrase harvest of imbecility. That's what we wanted to prevent, was getting an entire generation or continuing more generations of feeble-minded people. So,
let's back up real quick. When was this woman alive? I'm hoping not the 90s.
I think she died in the 60s, and she was kind of, her pioneering time was in the 1920s and 1930s. And from her, we get all of the modern birth control access that we have now. Like, I would have 17 kids right now if it wasn't for her. So we're all very grateful. Same time, she still did believe that if you had epilepsy, you should be sterilized. Or if you, she did not want immigration just anybody to come to America. She wanted them to be fit before they could come into our country. And that was part of her philosophy that tied all into her reproductive rights agenda. So I think the takeaway there is that if you are a pro-choice person, that's part of the narrative you want to forget. That's get swept under the rug. Planned Parenthood distanced themselves from that story a long time ago. But if you're pro-life, if you look this up on the internet, it's all over the place. They love this part about her because it totally speaks to their agenda, and it's a great origin story for Margaret Sanger.
So this is like old news for pro-life people. It just sounds like such pure, insane, over-the-top propaganda. It's like, okay, so what is the most villainous version of this agenda that we can create? And that's actually the truth?
Oh, yeah. When I was researching her, I went straight to her book to get her words because there's so much right-wing stuff about her out there. I mean, there's a whole racial component that they say is there. I didn't get that far in. But, like, there's a lot of allegations about her. But I went straight to, there's a book called Pivot of Civilization where she laid out her plan and how she thought we were going to create the fittest world in the future, and harvest of imbecility, those were her words.
It's amazing. When you go back and look at the popular culture in the 1920s, how close America was to tipping in the direction of Nazism, and there was a lot of people who were major figures in American culture who were really pro-eugenics. That's shocking.
It wasn't until we saw how that played out in its worst possible form that people were able to look at it, look at the philosophy and take a step back and say, okay, that's bad. But in theory, in their heads, it made perfect sense to use science to create perfect people. They just didn't see what that looked like until the 1930s and things got horrible. And so I think that's the defense that when Planned Parenthood has to talk about this origin, they put it in that context that this was a common philosophy. This was what a lot of smart people thought back then.
So, and she created Planned Parenthood. It's such a progressive organization. Those of us who believe in a woman's right to choose think it's a great bastion of progressive civilization that it would come out of the darkest hour of American thought is just shocking.
Well, she had this philosophy, but she also, at the same time, was running clinics that were providing reproductive care to women, and she had a clinic in Harlem that was staffed entirely by black staff. And I mean, she was doing good, progressive things, and it was just coupled with this weird idea that she had. She, at the same
time, it's a little more than weird.
their philosophy that was just didn't get played out in the same way that her good ideas did.
Uh-huh. All right, and you said you had a second one.
Right. And actually, I know this is a story you love, too. This is the story of crack babies.
Don't bring me into this shit, Christy, all right? I'm not in on your dark crusade.
So, in the 1980s, around the mid-1980s, we started seeing these reports and hearing these reports of these sick little babies that were born in the ghetto that were addicted to crack. And accompanying these stories were the pictures of the babies, and they were teeny tiny, and they had tubes attached to them, and they were shaky. They had diapers that just kind of swallowed up their bodies. They're just tiny. And we were told at the time that these children were going to have permanent mental and physical disabilities because of their crack addiction, that they were going to totally wreck the system, that they were going to need help for the rest of their lives from the state, and just get ready because they're going to hit the schools and we're all going to have to deal with them. And
right.
So
this was part of the future crime wave that the 80s promised us was coming, that there would be a future in the 90s when teenagers would just sweep to the streets, turning over cars and lighting everything on fire. And it's also where the term crack baby comes from, that is so ingrained in stupid name-calling popular culture.
True. I use it a lot.
You do. It's your favorite.
I do. It turns out that these reports were based on one study that only had 23 kids that they were studying. And all of those symptoms that they were reporting also correlated with poor nutrition and drinking alcohol during pregnancy and smoking and low birth weight. And they were just premature babies, that there was no such thing as a crack baby. That didn't exist. That these are children that had multiple things going on thanks to their environments, but there was nothing physically wrong with them that was strictly a crack problem. And so it didn't exist. And I don't think a lot of people know that. The story doesn't fit with that narrative that we fix in our heads of what happens when you take crack and have a baby, and we just forgot about it.
The stigma that comes with sort of the crack epidemic and crack babies and the whole anti-drug, anti-crack movement is that I had just always assumed that the worst thing you can do to your child when you're pregnant is smoke crack. It's not good. Doctors do not recommend that you smoke crack. But the thing that gets lost is that it's far worse to be a chronic user of alcohol. But the media in the 80s made it seem as though crack was this sort of button that if you pushed it, your baby was going to be underweight, and I'm trying to make it sound like we're not saying crack is okay to do when pregnant, but I don't think many Earwolf listeners are on the fence about whether to smoke crack or not while pregnant.
I think it's interesting, though, because drugs have been a part of the culture for a long time, and we know that women were smoking and drinking during pregnancy for years. They only just found out around this time that you're not supposed to drink and smoke during pregnancy. So why was it that crack was the one that got everybody worked up? I think that's interesting because it speaks to kind of who we were in the 80s, because this was a drug that was associated with the inner city, and it wasn't heroin, it wasn't pie, it wasn't anything else. It was crack that got people really worried. I'm pretty sure if you ask just an average person about what a crack baby is, they've got a very solid picture in their head of who it is and what they look like. Which is funny because the children grew up and they're in the workforce now and they're fine for the most part. I mean, they have the same problems that anybody would have when your mom smoked crack.
Right. It's not like they all grew up to be skinny, shaking people who like have bald patches on their head. They had all the problems that a premature baby would have, right? It's a health problem. It's no more insurmountable than the health problems that come with any sort of poor decisions made by a mother while pregnant. I think it's interesting that those are your two stories because those seem like the two moments in the 20th century when America was the closest to going down a very particular path of sort of, I think people can draw their own conclusions, but the 20s and the 80s, there's a lot of ways in which those decades rhyme with each other.
Yeah. I think that's actually perfect, because when we think of the 80s, we don't think of necessarily AIDS and crack babies and the drug war and the Cold War. We think of like a really goofball time with people looking like idiots wearing neon and walking around with boomboxes on their shoulders. And it's a totally frivolous decade, it seems like. And I think we kind of have those same images for the 20s as well. But underneath, there was just all
not the exact same years. Images, but yeah, it was like this time where the central main culture was all about celebrating success and excess, and there was this undercurrent of getting rid of these people who didn't fit in with that image.
My name was Kim, this light-skinned girl from Shaolin. Stood by my side when my world was caved in. She cooked for me, fixed me up, plus made me happy. Every time she told me she loved me, I said no backseats. I was fucked up in the game. Migraines, no honey in my pockets. All I had was a chain. 45 stainless, it got so deep I threw the heat to my dome. She said, if you shoot, you ain't the real pretty tone. Baby, come home, you're not alone. Be strong, whether right or wrong. My bond is even more strong.
Hey guys, we've got Tada.com sponsoring today's episode of the Cracked Podcast. Tada.com is an awesome online couponing site that wants to take the frustration out of trying to save money. While the web is flooded with discount codes, it is so hard to find coupons that are currently valid and that offer the best deal available. Expired coupons will stay up for weeks on other coupon websites before they're taken down. Tada.com is different. Tada shows you up-to-the-minute exchanges when coupon codes were last used by verified buyers. If you see a code that was reported as having been used within the last 2 minutes, you can be sure that the code is valid. Tada.com coupons are easy to search, and they're free. They get over 5,200 e-retailers on their website, so go check them out. Go to Tada.com, that's Tada.com, for the most up-to-date coupon codes on the web. Don't forget, Tada.com, that's Tada.com, next time you shop online. All right. Time to get back to the show. Thanks again for listening.
Man, every squint is possible. Help the kid get on out. Every obstacle, long talks at night. Arguments secure, trying to solve whether who is right. She mad tight in the way she never call a cop, so the nigga got me. Open even more on her with a banging body. My favorite sweetheart, come but don't ever stop. Your love, give me every drop. Your kiss gets me very hot. Never felt feelings before and felt so sure.
All right, guys, welcome back to the Origin Story episode of the Cracked Podcast. We are joined by Adam Ganser, aka The Gans, who does what for Cracked?
I'm the head of production.
H.O.P.
So I head up all the creation of the videos and the production plans there, and occasionally I'm forced to appear in podcasts and make jokes, direct a lot of the sketches, and then a bunch of other administrative duties that we're
you
all
get shit done.
Yeah, I'm a get shit done guy.
Adam has this amazing story about summer break.
Unfortunately, the conversation sort of keeps coming up whether or not we should have summer break at all. A popular sort of myth that's being propagated by virtually everybody, even like the president and people like that have said this in the last few months, is that summer break is based on the agrarian society we used to be, and it's for farmers, and that no longer makes sense for us now because we're now an industrialized nation. But that's actually not true. And in fact, the school year used to be significantly longer than it is now. In the 1840s, the U.S. school year was 260 days, which is longer than any current school year for any society now. Mm. Of course, most of the kids didn't show up. They would bail like for about five months of the year.
Super long school year, but that was in the era where truancy was such an issue that a series of cartoons featuring a truant officer rang true with everyone. They're like, oh yeah, my kid's at the fishing hole and you got to pick him up. I know what that's about.
Kid-sized nets. Yeah, absolutely. But if they wanted to, they could have gone 260 days a year.
And so they kind of kept it open in case kids stopped by.
The teacher was just waiting around.
Yeah, the convenience
kids
store
were
of education.
Show up. Yeah.
Just waiting, hoping. It costs money to keep a school open.
You know, the government's paying for it, and it's cheaper for them if we have a shorter school year.
Right. That wasn't the only reason they wanted to close it. They also felt that kids were too frail to undertake that much learning in the urban environment. They just thought all that
brains
learning.
Brains cannot take it.
They couldn't take it.
Their bodies can take labor. And like,
we can put them in the mines. That'll be fine, but they can't learn.
This all seems like a very convenient excuse for making money. Their brains are too feeble, but they still put them to work. We just don't want to spend that much money to have them. They're going to sit around all day and read?
Yeah, that begs the question then. Now that people who want America to win or whatever, want our kids to be less stupid. And like you said, even the president has made speeches calling for the longer school year.
I mean, we're trying out year-round school, but we're not actually adding school days. We're just sort of spreading the vacation around. There was another reason, actually, that they wanted to close down the school for the summer, and they just didn't have ventilation in the buildings. Like, it was unbearably hot in there. I mean, even if they had AC, which they didn't in the 20th century when they changed things.
They didn't even have open windows back then.
Yeah, they hadn't invented
stone,
that yet. And because of that, they were concerned about disease because those little plague rats were in there in the sweltering heat of the summer.
That's just how Adam refers to children, by the way.
The little plague rats. There he goes. I mean, everybody knows that the summer vacation creates a learning decline for children. But what studies are sort of finding now is that it causes a greater learning decline in children who have sort of lower economic means because they don't have supplemental programs or access to those. So, you know, people spend the whole summer not being able
to
do a whole
lot. So every year they
come
back, the different discrepancy is exaggerated by
summer break. And then over time, you can imagine how it's like a lower income area, the students would have retained less information.
When you look at comparisons between high income and low income schools, the test performances are the same heading into summer and then drop off in the lower income. And it's not just the rich kids are going to a smart people camp. It's also that the kids from lower income families, parents are more likely having to work longer hours and not be able to afford childcare.
So yeah, that problem has at least mildly classist, potentially racist overtones.
And I think it's fair to argue that in the long run, making our kids smarter would probably help the economy more than it would cost us to take away. That's right, kids. I'm arguing anti-summer break.
That's right. Well, welcome back to school.
I think both of you are, and I think it's lame, you guys.
Out of the reach of summer vacation, we're like, no one gets it. Why?
Exactly.
Because I'm scared of China. That's why.
I made that
through you, kid. You want a childhood? I'm scared of China. You work this summer.
Well, good origin story, Adam. Yeah. Thanks. Yeah, thanks for coming by.
You really justified your existence on the episode, I think.
Great.
All right. Now, Michael, you have origin story.
So I'm going to tell one theory, the origin of the Holocaust, or at least a theory for it, by which I mean in Hitler's brain. Like, why the Holocaust, Hitler, you crazy nut? First of all, Hitler's way more fucked up than even you thought. If you look into any human aspects of Hitler, it's crazy how crazy he was, and he did so many crazy things that you don't hear about because obviously he was overshadowed by the main thing. But one of the crazy things he did was have his girlfriend poop on him. It's crazy to me that that's not super common knowledge. We all know Hitler, hate Hitler. Wouldn't we all want to know? You know, he's a freak. He got pooped on. It's a loser.
It's a little, I think the reason we haven't heard it is because it's a little like hearing that Darth Vader had a weird fetish or something. You know, the History Channel and just history movies in general have a lot tied up in making Hitler an imposing villain that you have to respect.
Right. It would be weird if the narrator went, and thousands of Jews were turned into these camps. Hitler also liked being pooped on. Like, there's no way to weave it in. Right.
There's no natural segue into that, right?
It was from the journal of a girl that had pooped on him named Jelly. G-E-L-I, probably pronouncing it wrong. But she said, yeah, he would want me to squat over him. He would cover himself so that he didn't want to get dirty. That's important. He was, like, curious to see the butt functioning as it's pooping. And in a sexual way, obviously. So there's all this Freudian stuff. I never know how much I jive with Freudian stuff. You know, anal retentive and anal expulsive, which is the theory that as a child, if you become obsessed with poop, Freud takes it basically just as a symbol for shame. Either you think poop is shameful and that makes it dirty, taboo, and something you always hide, and that makes an anal retentive person. You clean things, you keep things in order. Or you're an anal expulsive personality type. Crazy party guy, doesn't care. I will shit in front of you if I have to shit and we're out in the woods or whatever. Doesn't find shame in
or
stuff.
Not
doesn't
out in
find
the woods.
It.
Right.
Yeah.
Just in my apartment.
And those are the two extremes. So the theory is that Hitler is an extremely anal retentive person who became obsessed with the taboo aspect of poop to the point that it was a sexual fetish, and that all holds up. But then the sort of interesting theory is, if you study his language about the elements of society that he wanted to murder, it's always they're unclean, they're a germ, they pollute the system, and we need to, in an organized fashion, cleanse them, and we'll be left with a purer, cleaner product. That is the metaphor that the whole Nazi party comes back to again and again. And the idea is just that maybe the fact that Hitler loved poop made him want to kill everyone. And that's the origin of the Holocaust, or at least one theory for it. So the other one I wanted to talk about with much more pleasure and relish is when the fucker shot himself in the head and was burned in a ditch. The origin of Hitler's downfall. Whenever you see him, it's like a guy who's really ruthless and smart, like an evil supervillain that you would imagine, at his wit's end and under pressure and maybe cracking a little.
Yeah.
But no, he was a batshit loony at the end, and there are many reports of that. This is the theory that I really buy after looking into it a lot. There was a doctor, Hitler's personal doctor, it's Michael Jackson all over before again, who became really close with Hitler and treated him for a variety of conditions, but all with the same thing. Historians have looked into his records. He didn't have a real doctorate. He was banned for being a quack, and his pills were known to be mostly meth. And there's records of Hitler wanting more and more, not liking other people, wanting to be only attended to by that doctor. So basically, he had a meth dealer who drove him crazy. Like, he shows very terrible judgment. Generals have said he shows poor strategic judgment at the end of the war. As soon as things start to crumble, he basically just goes nuts and let it fall apart, with much less aplomb than the guy who navigated his way up to the top of a party and ran the country and blah, blah, blah. And the theory is that this guy basically saved the world by getting Hitler addicted to meth until he was crazy and it was easy to take him out. And the funniest thing about it to me is that he first started taking the medication because he farted too much, and the guy said it would help with that. So poop made the Holocaust and farts killed Hitler.
So the origin story I wanted to talk about is America's, because I love America, y'all. Mm. The founding of America, and so we kind of know.
I know this story. If you loved America, you would not tell this story.
So we kind of know the two different founding episodes. There's Columbus showing up, and then there is the Pilgrims showing up. So I had never really thought about the fact that there's over 100 years between those two founding events. Why did the Pilgrims wait over 100 years to come over and just settle the land? They don't really mention that. They're just like, and then some people needed religious freedom, and so they were the first people who ever thought to go over and settle America. Well, so the truth is that during that period, America was thickly populated by Native Americans. Mm-hmm. So we picture Native Americans as being sort of roaming packs of hippies who gather around bonfires. The truth is that they cut down so many trees that there's a Stanford scientist think that the death of the Native Americans caused a mini ice age, because all the trees that they used to cut down grew back. Uh-huh. And so there's so much more carbon. Or so
oh,
much
wow.
less.
That's insane.
Yeah. Yeah. It was like reverse global warming, right, basically. So once the trees grew back, it created a cold snap in Europe that lasted a century.
So to fight global warming, murder Indians?
Yeah. That's right. But anyways, this one guy sailed down the East Coast and described it as densely populated and so smoky with Indian bonfires that you could smell them burning hundreds of miles out at sea. America was settled, full of people. So the next part of the story that gets left out is that we hear about smallpox blankets and stuff. There's also, like, we won a bunch of wars against them. And
right. Trail of Tears.
Right. But what actually happened is that right before the Mayflower came and landed on the East Coast, a plague wiped out 96% of the Indians in Massachusetts.
I have never heard that.
I've never heard that either.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it was an apocalypse. Right. There had been Europeans fishing off of Cape Cod for 100 years since Columbus discovered. And so they just kind of came to land and camped there, and they think that's how it got started.
Right. So why didn't a Native American disease also wipe out everyone on the boat, Columbus's boat, as he sailed
back?
So
there are a few theories about this. One is that they did not live in densely populated cities with livestock. And most of our most horrible diseases came about because we're living with cow and pig shit. And also, one theory is that when they were coming across the Bering Strait, the only people who survived had crazy strong immune systems that could just kill off anything. So by the time they arrived, generations of people kind of having to make it across this frozen tundra, their immune system was just totally clean. Jeez. Something about that passage made it so that they were basically clean of germs. The germs hadn't survived.
Or at least insofar as they had had no antibody defense for new kinds of diseases they might encounter.
Well, the way that you evolve antibodies is by
contacting with
filthy shit.
Yeah.
And they just lived more cleanly. When the Europeans arrived, the natives were like, God, these people smell like shit. In Europe at the time, they thought that bathing actually exposed you to
disease.
So the natives actually practiced good hygiene, so they just weren't prepared for these like filthy, disease-ridden people who came across the Atlantic.
Yeah.
The diseases swept down the East Coast, killed off, estimates are 90% of Native Americans before any settlers.
Wait, so you said 96 in Massachusetts, you said
96
90.
And 90 nationwide.
Nationwide?
Yeah. So basically the way it works.
He came, dropped off a disease, and bounced, and everyone died.
And so we never met.
That's crazy.
And we never met the Native Americans as they were.
There's Columbus, and then we have these sparse accounts of, like, sailors. The guy
who's come by.
Right, who sailed up the East Coast and was like, holy shit, there is a city in what is present-day East St. Louis that in 1250 was bigger than London.
In terms of human population?
Yeah, human population. There were trade routes that went as far south as the Gulf of Mexico. It was a complex society. Estimates are that it was anywhere between 20 and 100 million Native Americans living in America before the plague.
Wow. Was there any overarching contact between tribes and stuff? Because like you said, we always consider them as like these tribal sort of roaming people. But you're telling me there were cities that were essentially wiped out by plague.
I have understood that they were certainly like nation states, like tribes
Like
had beefs against other tribes and would wage wars, and they had fully functioning nations.
That's actually a really interesting thing, is that when you look at the primary documents from early on when the American government is being formed, they're drawing more from Iroquois governments than they are from Western European. Western Europe, when you think about the colonies at first, everything was like a different sort of nation state, like Massachusetts was its own, which is how Western Europe is set up, right? And they would go to war with each other.
Right.
The idea for putting everyone together and like having these different groups that all live together under one national kind of government.
The United States.
Right. When Ben Franklin talks about that in the early days, he keeps referencing like, well, if the Iroquois can do it, why can't we?
Like all live and care about the nation over the individual states.
Yeah. Right. There's basically this apocalypse. The white guys show up and they can't believe how amazing the untamed American wilderness is, because you can drive a cart through like the forest.
And
because
it's never
but it's
anyone.
It's because it was cleared
That's
out
because
by
the,
it's,
the right. people who made the road all died.
Right. Exactly.
It's nuts.
The story.
It's just so weirdly, my thought about America was always that, man, Europeans really had it easy as far as conquering and getting the most geographically dense land-rich mass that's on this planet. They had it even easier than I thought. They just walked up and were like, we'll take all of the world's resources. We live here now. They had to do so little, it sounds like. It's crazy.
They got as lucky as I think it
as a tribe of humans on Earth can get. Yeah.
Right, exactly. And that's why they've experienced unprecedented success since then.
Sure.
Yeah, it's been nice.
But when you look But when you look at other nations that had native populations, like China, Africa, you know, India, when you think of Chinese people, African people, Indian people, you don't picture white European settlers, right?
Speak for yourself.
I'm
an old school imperialist.
Right. The reason for that is because a plague didn't wipe out the native population there. And the story we always hear is like, well, we had superior weapons, guns versus arrows.
Yeah.
It's like rock, paper, scissors.
We didn't give a shit also.
Right. But it still implies we're the superior culture.
I don't want human suffering to be sewn back into the universe, but you'd almost wonder how it would go down if we still wanted America, but there was a population the size of London with bows and arrows that could darken the sky and fight us. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like, if there actually was a war for America.
For sure. I mean, we couldn't have the amount of people over there to sustain a fight against that number of bows and arrows.
Yeah. So these are some quotes from pilgrims when they came over and decided on Plymouth. They chose Plymouth Rock because of its beautiful cleared fields, recently planted in corn, and its useful harbor. All because the natives had like built that.
What did
it's
they
like,
think of the heliport?
Right, exactly. The biggest problem in the early days that has been deleted from history is settlers going native, defecting to the tribes. Everybody thought the native society was better than
what
European society.
On, yeah.
Ben Franklin at the time said, "No European who has tasted savage life can afterwards bear to live in our societies."
Wow.
It was a better way of life.
Yeah.
And they just died off and we're now like, oh, they were cute people. They were, you know.
Yeah. See, it makes me wonder if any Europeans describe the Native Americans as like, they all smell great.
They do.
They do.
Actually.
They just. Oh, someone said
it's,
that.
It's like they had.
They
a,
don't stink like us.
That's
why not?
It's like they had a man crush, and
yeah, the noble savage was a popular icon that arose.
But they described them as like beautiful. They were like, I've never seen such a beautiful figure in my life.
A quote from some high-ranking member of a tribe said, "What do you think of white people?" And he said, "We all." Like, if we want to do an impression, we look worried. Why are you guys all so worried? It looks like you're always searching the horizon for an oncoming ship that's going to attack you or something. Why is everyone so worried all the time? And the guy was just like, I don't know. That's how white people are. And it makes you think, I don't know, it makes you think in this industrialized society, an outside culture seeing it is, do they all look worried to you? They all look worried all the time. That makes you think about, I wonder if chilling out, when you know, communing with the land might be better. I don't know. But they didn't actually have helipads, so
yeah.
Pocket.
Poor thing. As beautiful in stature and build as I can possibly describe is how a white dude described the first Native American chief that he saw.
Wow.
And then he said, for a dude, but...
no homo.
Yeah.
The last thing on this I want to talk about is the Roanoke mystery. Mm-hmm. We think of it as this mysterious disappearance of this colony. The thing you've probably heard is that they left behind the word Croatan, which was this mysterious word that didn't make any sense, carved into the town post. Actually, Croatan was the name of a nearby island, which was populated by a bunch of friendly Native Americans. And about 2 years after the settlers on Roanoke disappeared, a bunch of gray-eyed, pale-skinned Indians started showing up. But we have to erase that because we can't acknowledge the fact that they might have had an attractive society that was like
right, that their society came over and it's like, you're setting up a pretty good camp. You want to come over to our island? It's all set up and it's
all
chill.
Their women
and they
immediately
all said yes.
Left.
They all just said yeah.
All their
better.
Women immediately left and went and fucked them. They had to actively guard the settlers to
the
keep them from...
chief whipped his dick out and carved Croatan into the signpost.
And
well.
Thus it was said.
Like a rock waller, who will relate? We play for high stakes at gunpoint. Catch him and break, undress him, time with tape. No escape, the Corleone, Fettuccine, Capone. Home in your own zone, or get kidnapped and clapped in your dome. We got it sewn, the firm, all the wars unknown. Lower your tone, face it, homicide cases get thrown. Aristocrats, politic and deli with diplomats. See me, I'm unofficial Mac, Lex, Cooper,
criminal thoughts in the group wars, my destiny to be.
The more of these stories that we've discussed and talked about, Michael, I feel like the more we've realized that the fake ones, the ones that we make up because we desperately want to believe them, all seem to have a similar shape to them.
Well, all the origin stories we're hearing for, like, they're from everywhere, you know? They're from, like, all walks of life, like keyboarder. But yeah, you're right, and when we make them up, it's much more defined.
Right, it's like the Robert McKee story structure. We want these stock characters, it seems like. We want to believe that those exist. The true stories that we've looked at, Wikipedia started out avoiding the one thing that would end up making them great, so that's like a fun, you know, inspiring, wacky story. Native Americans, that story is a post-apocalyptic.
Scrappy like, underdog, but it doesn't really follow, like, the Rudy trajectory.
Right. The truth was that they...
The scrappy underdog got destroyed and driven to the brink of extinction.
Right. And they were the scrappy underdog, and we were not. We were just the people wandering in and getting to use their stuff.
No.
Hitler is secretly a comedy. The Hitler movie is kind of Forrest Gump with a poop fetish. But we turn those stories, we make those stories into what we want them to be, which is stories where the people who represent us or the people that we want to identify with become Rudy. They become Luke Skywalker going up against the Empire and having to make this one in a million shot.
Right, and almost even the stories that are partially true, anytime we tweak it or fabricate it, it's always like pushing it towards that
movie story structure that we love.
So think about the stuff that gets deleted from the Hitler story. So he's a drug-addicted stoop who sleeps through the Battle of Normandy because he's, you know, on methamphetamines because he is treating his farting defect. that does not work if Darth Vader is doing those things. If Darth Vader sleeps through an important battle, it's not as tense a movie. It's not as interesting a movie. So we have to make him into an evil genius.
An inconvenient poop, if you will. Again, what we're talking about, it's fabrication, right? It's taking your origin, even the first origin story, they're changing the details. Well, that made me interested in our origin story, right? The origin of the podcast. Because I thought it's pretty interesting story. And what's crazy is it's interesting even being totally truthful about it. It really is an interesting story.
No, you did a really, it's almost journalistic account of how this podcast came to be in rap form. And we're gonna share that with the audience. Am.
Jack, do you know the part you're gonna do, or should I spell it out for you like you're an audience participant?
Like an audience participant.
What I would love for you to do is, and it starts with the chorus, so this will be, I'll point at you also, but there's a part where I'm going to need you to say, what? And you're going to want to say, like, what? But don't. Goal for you is to say it, like, I don't know, a different way every time.
Okay.
But not that way. Not like, what?
So not the way that I typically say what.
Not the way where you normally slay raps.
Right. Exactly.
The way where I think it'll be funny. All right, here we go. That's the problem with a podcast so glorious. It's forcing us to forage for an origin story.
What?
Yeah, that's the problem with a podcast so glorious. It's forcing us to forage for an origin story.
What?
Chickens come from eggs, and eggs in turn from chickens. And if you don't know which came first, check evolution's definition. Evolution came from Darwin. Darwin came from a vagina. But if you came from where Waldo's from, well, good luck trying to find you. I'm trying to remind you. It's all about tapping roots. Without Doc Hammer, the intangible fancy goes poof. Before America, man, he wasn't captain of poops, which come from everyone's butts. If you must be kept in the loop, and that's a phrase that originated in an operator's booth. But what can I offer as proof? As we talk to the youth, that Jack and I proffer nothing but the God's honest truth. See? That's the problem with a podcast this glorious. It's forcing us to forage for an origin story.
What?
Yeah, that's the problem with a podcast this glorious. It's forcing us to forage for an origin story.
What?
All right, here comes the breakdown. You ready? Podcast origin. We came from nowhere, man. We came from nothing. Yesterday, my man Jack came from huffing too much Robitussin. Whereas Mila Kunis's cuteness is the sire of this nut I'm busting. Rappers lie about their sex lives, right? This just in. What were we discussing? Oh, right. Where the podcast came from, man. I remember it like it was yesterday, because I'm on some insane drugs. First, Jack burst through the door with a roar and a Uzi. Said, let the bodies hit the floor like he's seen in a movie. He screamed, this is my boomstick, baby. Ain't it groovy? And he ain't ever seen that flick, man. The dude is straight screwy. Then the Sklar brothers blew me. Jake Fogelnest too. We got first place in an exaggeration contest they threw. They said, you dudes are so raw, can we get you on the air? And I said, whatever I'm on, I'm high as fuck and I don't care. Wherever there's a motherfucking mic that needs to be motherfucking cussed, and you'll all fucking be there. Well, Jack comes and huffs Robitussin.
What?
Final thoughts about origin stories, because we
final already. Okay, where this is final, because I feel like we didn't cover, we said a lot of origin stories, but at the top we said why we were gonna say why.
Okay, so origin stories are important, right? Mm-hmm. People always bring up the first lines of novels,
but why, Jack?
So we tell stories in general to give ourselves meaning, right? Whether it's the Bible or the movies we go see, we're creating meaning within the world. It's giving our existence meaning and direction, right? When you look at human history, the first 97% is all oral tradition. So I just saw Werner Herzog's documentary about, that was a great Werner Herzog, his documentary Cave of Forgotten Dreams, where he looks at the oldest cave paintings in existence. So the things that they draw, right? At first I was like, well, that proves that they were just weird and completely different from us. All it is animals and a naked woman having sex with a boar or a, like... Oh, no.
Yeah, and she's giant.
It's like a centaur,
she's
right?
Shaped weirdly, too.
Yeah, they do.
There's a particular shape of woman that everyone's obsessed with, yeah, at that time.
But also, the guys were like cat people.
Well, furry art, essentially.
Exactly.
We started
with
furry art.
So that's what I realized, is the very first images that come into creation are food, because it's the animals that these people hunt.
It's the equivalent of watching the Food Network at 2 a.m.
Exactly.
Like, I wish I had that bison.
It's naked women having sex with catmen, which is the internet. I think that's why origin stories are important, is because they tell us things about ourselves. That,
like, that we want to be catmen,
yeah,
having sex with large women and eating.
That we've always been. And for people who might not be religious, that's the genesis right there, right? Is the first art, the first stories we're telling are of a woman who had sex with
a centaur.
Cat guy, a thunder cat.
In the beginning, there was a centaur.
Exactly.
And he was hung. 190 mixed with baby oil and shit. Your man's in the kitchen stashing ice picks. While I'ma end this with a big red cherry on top. Me, Nas, and Ray got the best product on the block. My whole team is up. Throw your hands shit. Up. Good cock shit, back nigga. The next time, don't say whatever y'all want. Keep your eyes open and wild in your fly shit. Floating on the nines, nigga. Sing the
alright guys, credits, footnotes, whatever, I forget what we call this. So this episode being origin stories, I thought I would play some of my favorite hip-hop from when I was a kid, from my origin as a rap fan. And these musicians also kind of appear to have shaped the music taste of the people who make modern hip-hop. The rapper Danny Brown just released a song called ODB, Drake's album. Quotes verses from songs that I grew up rapping badly in the shower, and has a song called Wu-Tang Forever that doesn't sound anything like a Wu-Tang song. Wu-Tang Forever is the album that the song at the beginning of this podcast appears on. Total coincidence, I just really like that song and think everybody should be crazy about it. I did use one new song in there because I'm really excited. I just found out about this guy Young Gutted, Y-U-N-G, Gutted. I just learned about that from the Get Up On This podcast, which, seriously, that's like the greatest podcast. You guys should definitely be listening to it, subscribing. The medley featured the Ten Crack Commandments by Biggie Smalls, which I almost didn't use. It almost seems too on the nose, but we do lists. Our name is Cracked, and we had a story in this podcast about the crack epidemic, and so it just felt right. Also, I have always said that rule nombre uno is never let no one know how much dough you hold. In the middle of the medley, we transition to the beat from New York State of Mind, the first song on the album that made me love hip-hop, Nas's Illmatic. More about Nas later. The medley, you heard the hilarious and talented comedy writer Alex Schmidt talk about Wikipedia and Michael Jordan. Telling the story of Star Trek was Randall Maynard, who is a gifted artist who has made pretty much every image in every Cracked article of the past 6 years. Super talented dude. Talked to video producer Brendan Carter about Caligula. And close it out with head writer Daniel O'Brien talking about Ketchup. You heard Save Me Concubine, which is a mashup of Ghostface Killah and Beirut, who is a weird young musician who I really love. Next, you heard Affirmative Action off of Nas's second album, It Was Written. Again, I deprived you of a Nas verse. That was actually Az or AZ. I'm just now realizing I've never said that rapper's name out loud, even though he was on a bunch of early Nas tracks and has some great verses. I always picture him as the boy on the cover of Illmatic, even though I know that is Nas, but AZ sounds like a little boy, and so that's what my brain spits at me. And now AZ is 41, and I feel old. And then finally, last, you finally heard from Nas, one of my favorite Nas verses, and just verses in general, off of one of my favorite rap songs, Verbal Intercourse, which is on Raekwon's Strictly for Cuban Links. Hope you guys learned about some great classic hip-hop, and go buy those albums and make some old dudes rich. They're all still alive, for the most part. And yeah, they deserve it. Tune in next week. We're probably gonna have a couple more episodes about origin stories, covering it from a few different angles. Hope you enjoyed it. hold on to your butts.
Jack surrendering, come home not remembering. Made bail with different size kicks on, a white dress shirt, looking gay in the yard, and you got hurt in flashbacks for the day room. Mop ringing style, your faggot ass got bashed, trying to turn it down. You told your boo you was wildin'. Once you heard Wu out of the blue, your family's from Shaolin. High class cooks, no one vests out of phone books. Infirmary niggas are screaming, our guns shoot. Sharpen toothbrushes, 190.
This has been an Earwolf Media production. Executive producers Jeff Ulrich and Scott Aukerman. For more information, visit earwolf.com.
Earwolf Radio Boom.com. Oh, oh, oh. The wolf dead.